after an energetic bout of construction work, which appears to have employed pretty much every able-bodied labourer, woodcutter, stonemason and builder in the Near East, Israel now has a temple, a permanent worship site for the first time in its history. It's been a big change since the battle-weary reign of David, and Solomon's rule appears to be one continuous lap of honour. It's now time to bring the nation's most sacred artifact into its new home and to host one of the most fabulous state visits ever imagined. My name is Chaz Bayfield and this is Holy Bible Episode 78, Gold, Ivory and Baboons. Hi Bible fans! Even if you're not Bible fans at all, it's quite possible that you're here because you simply feel a need to better understand this book that has been flying off shelves for millennia. Well, you've found the right place. The Bible certainly doesn't need improving, and all this podcast does is condense, paraphrase, and modernize it while adding a bit of narrative voice to drive the story forward. I hope you get something out of it. We're in the middle of the Bible's 11th book. Israel's third king, Solomon, is on the throne, and he's already built a temple and a couple of palaces. Now he needs to put them all to good use. Let's jump in. The centerpiece of the temple is the Ark of the Covenant. This, for those of you new to the podcast, is the sacred golden chest in which the Jews keep the stone tablets on which are inscribed the Ten Commandments, and which they believe is the earthly resting place of God. The arrival of the holy casket in the temple is a seminal moment in Israel's history. Solomon summons the nation's leaders, tribal heads and family chiefs to Jerusalem to witness the event, and a vast number of regular Israelites come along to watch the festivities. Priests remove the ark from the tent where it has been living ever since David brought it to the city and place it in the Holy of Holies, beneath the outstretched wings of the golden cherubim. Feel free to skip back an episode to familiarise yourself with the temple, but as you might divine from its name, the Holy of Holies is the most sacred room in Israel. A perfect square, it is designed to hold the ark. The cherubim are the heavenly creatures who guarded the entrance to the Garden of Eden, and two golden cherubs are set in place to keep watch over the ark. The priests bring the tent itself, as well as all its sacred furnishings, to Solomon's temple, and so many sheep and cattle are sacrificed that readers are told that they cannot be counted. According to the book, the poles used for transporting the ark remain with it, and it contains nothing but the tablets on which are written the commandments. Interestingly, no mention is made in the Bible of what becomes of Aaron's rod or the jar of manna that were originally kept in the ark. As the priest leaves, the room fills with dense cloud, which the book describes as the glory of the Lord, making it impossible for the men to fulfil their functions. Solomon connects the cloud to the presence of God, which the scriptures describe as appearing in clouds, and he tells God that he has built him a magnificent home in which he can live forever. Solomon then blesses everyone who has gathered here to celebrate this momentous event in their nation's history. He bursts into effusive praise of God, who he believes has fulfilled his promise to David and allowed all this to happen. God not only brought his people out of Egypt, he tells the crowd, he approved of David's desire to build a permanent residence for God in Jerusalem and kept his promise to put David on the throne. Israel's king acknowledges that it was his father who wanted to build the temple, but that God's plan was for Solomon to lay the first brick. He tells the great and good gathered around him that God has kept his promises. Solomon is king. He has built the temple and placed inside it the 10 fundamental rules that form Israel's official covenant with God. The arrival of the ark in the temple is an emotional moment for Israel's king, and he launches into a prayer of thanks. Solomon falls to his knees at the altar, raises his hands to heaven, and tells God that there is no one like him. God keeps his promises to his people, he tells him. This is never truer than the vows he made to David, who he told would never be without a successor on his throne as long as these kings live in a way that pleases him, like David did. Solomon prays for this promise to come true. In a moment of clarity, he acknowledges that the God of the heavens is too majestic to be contained in a building on earth, but he begs God to at least keep an eye on the temple and to answer the prayers of him and his people, forgiving them. He prays that when people come to the altar to decide legal cases, God will hear the arguments from heaven, condemning the guilty and vindicating the innocent. He prays that, should the people lose a war because they have turned against God, they will return to him and praise him in the temple. He prays that God hears them and forgives them and restores any land that they might have lost. The king asks that God will hear the prayers made in the temple during times of hunger, again, something which Solomon equates with punishment for sin. He asks God to forgive his people, to teach them the right way to live, and to send much-needed rain. Be it famine, plague, crop disease, a locust swarm, or enemy attacks, Solomon prays for the temple to be an earthly place where people can come before God and have the sins which he believes might have caused these hardships forgiven. The king shares his belief that God knows every human heart and prays that he will deal with everyone according to how they behave. That way, they will live in acute awareness of his presence and power. He asks for the temple to be a place where foreigners who have heard of God's power have their prayers answered so that news of God can travel far and wide. Solomon prays that Israel can turn towards the temple in the heat of battle to swing the fight their way. Should the people's faith go off the boil so completely that they find themselves captive in another country, Solomon asks that they can pray towards their temple and be treated humanely by their captors and repatriated, just as they were rescued from Egypt. Solomon asks God to be tuned in to any requests made by him of his people and thanks him for singling out Israel as his chosen nation, just as he promised Moses he would. Standing again, the king blesses the whole of Israel, thanking God for bringing peace and rest to the nation and honouring all the promises which he made to them. He asks God never to leave his people and to help them live in line with his laws. He begs God to be mindful of his prayer and to fight for Solomon and Israel. He implores God to protect and provide for them in a way that all people of all nations are left in no doubt that he is the only God worth worshipping. Solomon then asks his people to commit themselves to being upright citizens, dedicated to keeping God's laws. To oil the machinery of temple worship and set a good example to his people, Solomon then sacrifices a staggering 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep and goats. The building is officially dedicated to worshipping God. The sheer volume of offerings is so great that the king has to consecrate the courtyard in front of the temple to cope with the overflow. The mass of people who have gathered to represent the entire nation of Israel spend the next 14 days celebrating the Festival of Tabernacles. Once the party is over, Solomon sends his people home, and the book reports that it is a moment of immense joy in the nation. Israel's people have given the king their blessing, truly grateful for the goodness which they believe God has shown to David and their country, a true high point in the Old Testament. After the drama of David's often chaotic reign, the account of Solomon seems an anticlimax. The action stagnates as the king builds, spends money, and hosts royal visits. Solomon also has dreams, and once the temple and royal palace have been completed to his specification, he has another vision where he believes that God speaks to him. In the dream, the king is given the satisfying confirmation by God that he has heard his prayer and that he has blessed the temple which Solomon has built for him, promising that as long as Solomon continues to follow him, one of his descendants will sit on Israel's throne. In a condensed version of the curses promised by Moses should his people turn away from God, Solomon is told that God will cut the people off, reject their fabulous temple, and make them a laughingstock among all other countries. People will look at the pile of rubble that was once their centre of worship and tell one another that this is the logical end result of Israel rejecting the God who rescued them from Egypt. After Solomon has been king for 20 years, he gifts Hiram of Tyre 20 cities in Galilee as a thank you for all his help with supplying building materials. Hiram is deeply unimpressed with the cities. However, he still gifts Solomon 4 tons of gold, possibly as the city's value is still more than the building materials he sent down to Israel, with the gold paying for the shortfall. Solomon is also a huge fan of forced labour, using his vast conscripted workforce to not only build the temple and his palaces, but to rebuild the terraces and walls of Jerusalem, as well as the cities of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Gezer had been a Canaanite city which Egypt's king had sacked and burned, then given to his daughter as a wedding gift when she married Solomon. Solomon dramatically improves 3 other cities, as well as building cities filled with provisions for his troops and towns where he keeps his chariots and horses. Many of his workforce come from the Canaanite kingdoms which Israel failed to subdue. These people are conscripted into slave labour, but the Israelites are spared the heavy lifting and serve instead as soldiers, officials, and project managers. To get an idea of the scale of the building projects undertaken by Solomon, he appoints 550 supervisors to oversee the work. Solomon's Egyptian wife is given a palace all to herself because the king sees his own palace as holy. It's possible that the ark remains in here before arriving at the temple, and, as a non-Jew, his wife's presence so close to such a holy artifact might be seen as offensive to God. Once Pharaoh's daughter leaves the royal palace for her own purpose-built pied-à-terre, Solomon infills the area just inside the city walls, creating terraces. He honours the 3 major festivals that draw people to Jerusalem every year, ensuring that the requisite sacrifices are made. In line with the orders put in place by his father, Solomon also appoints priests and gatekeepers to oversee the running of the temple. For the first time in its history, Israel has a navy. Solomon begins shipbuilding at the Red Sea port of Ezion-Geber, near modern-day Eilat, on the Gulf of Aqaba. Hiram, whose people are well versed in seafaring, sends men to help Solomon sail his fleet. The ships are more for trade than defence, and the Bible records them sailing to a distant place called Ophir, which might have been Zimbabwe, India, Sri Lanka, or even the Philippines, where they return with a staggering 13 tons of gold, all of it for Solomon. Despite the popular novel by H. Rider Haggard, no evidence of mines filled with gold, jewels and ivory has been found in Africa. However, archaeologists have found a vast 3,000-year-old mining camp in Israel's Timna Valley, 18 miles north of Eilat, which has more of a historical claim to being the actual site of King Solomon's mines. If you're not familiar with imperial measurements, I put the metric ones in the notes. News of Solomon's opulence travels, and other teachers are keen to see the splendour for themselves. The Bible recounts one such royal visit. In perhaps the grandest state visit ever imagined, the Queen of Sheba and her retinue travel almost 2,000 miles from a kingdom south of Ethiopia to Jerusalem, bearing some of the most fabulous gifts ever given to one monarch by another. Laden with gold, spices, precious stones and cedarwood in the kind of quantities that the world has never seen and perhaps never will again, the queen arrives with some tough questions for the king. The details of her exact line of inquiry are not given, but the suggestion is possibly that she is assessing whether or not Israel poses a threat to her kingdom. According to the account of her visit, no question phases the king, and the heady mix of her host's wisdom, the scale and opulence of his palace, the catering, Solomon's abundance of impeccably turned out staff, and his sacrificial offerings overwhelmed the queen. She admits to the king that she was sceptical of the legends which she had heard of his fabled kingdom, but the experience has far outweighed her expectations. The reality is twice as fabulous, she tells him. The queen can only guess how happy the king's people and officials must be to have such a wise ruler. Convinced that divine forces must be at play, she praises Israel's God. In what appears to be one of the Bible's most heartfelt prayers to God by a pagan, she announces that he is clearly delighted with his king and praises his everlasting love for Israel. This is why he has made Solomon king, she says, and doing so will ensure that justice and morality will be maintained. The amount of gold brought by the queen weighs 4 tons, and to this are added large quantities of spices and precious stones. As if to emphasize the wealth pouring into Israel at this time, the writer notes that Hiram's ships returned from Ophir with a haul of gold, gemstones, and a rare wood called almug. In an aside, readers are told that some of this rare wood is used to make supports for the temple and royal palace, and some is used to fashion harps and lyres for the temple musicians. Unsurprisingly, this fabulous meeting of monarchs has been a favourite subject for artists, particularly during the Renaissance. Tintoretto's Queen of Sheba and Solomon hangs in Madrid's Prado, while London's National Gallery has Claude Lorrain's 17th century Embarkation of the Queen of Sheba. Her tour of Jerusalem over, Solomon packs the Queen's ships with gifts of his own, and she sails back to Sheba, her head no doubt still spinning. According to Jewish tradition, the Queen of Sheba is a monarch in her own right, rather than simply being the wife of a king. She is also the only prominent black woman in the Bible. Wise as Solomon may be, the accounts of his reign in the Bible are dominated by his wealth and splendour. Even before the contributions from merchants, traders, foreign heads of state and his own governors, the king brings in an annual total of 23 tons of gold. He makes 200 large golden shields and 300 smaller ones, which between them use 1.7 tons of gold. The king hangs these in his private palace, where he sits on an ornate ivory throne. This spectacular seat is overlaid with gold and has a lion carved into each arm. 12 more lions sit either end of the 6 steps that lead up to the throne, and all Solomon's drinking vessels and other utensils are made from pure gold. In fact, there is so much gold floating around the palace complex that silver has almost no value. At the same time that his eastern fleet is trading with Ophir, Solomon commandeers a second armada of trading ships, possibly heading west towards Spain. Every 3 years, the vessels return carrying a cargo of gold, silver, and ivory, as well as apes and baboons. Though what the king does with these notoriously angry monkeys isn't recorded. Solomon's reputation for wisdom and wealth wins him plenty of international admirers. The book describes his wealth and wisdom as greater than any king in the world. Guests arrive from all corners, intent on hearing the wisdom that Israel's God has imparted to his chosen king, bringing with them as gifts all the things that are considered of value to a Near Eastern king in around 950 BC. Silver, gold, robes, weapons, spices, horses and mules all make their way to Jerusalem. During his reign, the king amasses 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he keeps in specially appointed towns. Again, Israel's wealth under Solomon is recorded as being so great that silver coins are like pebbles in the street, and cedar is as common as the sycamore figs that grow like weeds. There is a lively horse and chariot trade between Egypt and Israel, with Israel's merchants selling the stock on to neighbouring Canaanite kingdoms. This is truly a golden age. Israel has its own sun king, a man who worships God and who appears to be rewarded with matchless material splendour. Slowly, though, Solomon begins to lose the plot as his fabulously expensive lifestyle and his taste for exotic wives from countries whose women Israelites are forbidden by God to marry start to work against him. God's instruction to his people expressly forbids them to marry outside of Israel, and a king should be God's representative on earth and live beyond reproach. The reason God wants his people to keep their marriage vows within Israel is that he doesn't want to risk heads being turned to foreign gods, as might happen if a man's spouse is a Hittite or from Sidon, Ammon, Moab, or Edom. Even Solomon's marriage to Pharaoh's daughter is questionable, as there's no need for foreign alliances when faith in God should dictate that the king can defeat all comers. Without giving too much away, this is the beginning of the end for Israel's monarchy, or at least where it all starts to go wrong. Solomon reigns like a human king, not a god, and his thinking is very much rooted in human decision-making rather than unwavering faith that God will provide. More poor decisions follow, and the scene is set for not only the collapse of the monarchy, but the breakup of the kingdom itself. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. You can follow us if you like on Twitter, search Holy Bible Podcast. And if you like reading, why not download a copy of Snakes and Angels, a secular walk through the first five books of the Bible, available on Amazon. Thanks for listening. See you next time. succession. The plague.